we are now continuing from last time. The book I mentioned on randomized algorithm is by Motwani and Raghavan. Despite the cool reception that my first paper on probabilistic algorithms, randomized algorithms, has received, I said to myself in the subsequent 5 to 10 years to find more and more applications of randomizations in computations. And among other things, I wrote a paper on very extensive applications of randomized algorithms to computations in finite fields. That was one thing I did. And further applications of randomization to number theoretical computations. For example, in 1977, in my MIT class, I presented an algorithm for efficiently expressing a number, an integer rather, as a sum of all squares. Lagrange has proven in 1770 that every integer is a sum of four squares of integers. There was no efficient algorithm for doing it. In 1977, I found an efficient algorithm for doing that computation. The algorithm used randomization. That algorithm later on appeared in a joint paper with Jeff Shalit in 1986, together with additional applications of randomization to number theoretic algorithms. Another interesting application was to the problem of so-called Byzantine agreement, namely the problem, a very famous problem in distributed computing is that there are n parties, each holding a private value, which is supposed to be or ought to be common to all of them, but may not be common to all of them, not the same value held by everybody. And they have to agree on a common value by exchanging messages. The term Byzantine enters into this because according to the first formulation of the problem by Pease, Lamport and somebody else is that some of the parties may be dishonest and may tell some of their colleagues that they are holding one value and others of their colleagues that they are holding another value privately. And consequently, a simple exchange of messages and a decision on a common value by majority is not going to work because of that Byzantine nature of the behavior. So, already...
Let me just check one thing. Yeah, everything is fine.
Yeah. Already Pease and Lamport have demonstrated that... I should state what is considered the solution to that problem. Namely, in the protocol, some of the participants are going to be proper or honest, while others are going to behave in a Byzantine manner, probably even coordinating amongst themselves their responses and behavior so as to make agreement impossible. And already Pease and Lamport have shown that if there are end participants, then agreement would require, using classical algorithms, would require n plus 1 rounds of exchanges of messages, A, and B, that agreement is impossible if more than one third of the participants are Byzantine. Now, Pease-Lamport formulated the problem for a synchronous system in which all the participants are on the same clock, and there are clocked rounds for the exchange of messages. Patterson, Fisher, and Nancy Lynch have shown that in the asynchronous case, agreement is impossible even amongst three participants, even when two of them are proper, are honest. So the Byzantine agreement problem in the early 80s was a centrally important topic in distributed computing, and I have heard about this problem from Benny Dolev, who at the time had some of the best results on protocols for achieving Byzantine agreement. And I immediately saw that randomization could be helpful here, meaning that the participants are going to exchange messages, but are going to update their information, their private information, using also coin tosses. Sometimes update the information in a certain way based on what they have heard from others, and at other times, depending on the result of the coin toss, not update. And within actually a day, I have shown that if they do have a common coin toss, then actually Byzantine agreement is achievable in three rounds, exchanging a very small number of messages. Three rounds means expected. The expected number of rounds is three. This also highlighted the importance of a common coin toss. I had an algorithm for establishing a common coin by use of cryptography, and later on a very extensive work resulted in absolute algorithms not requiring cryptography. I'm happy to say that one of the main contributors to that was my daughter Tal Rabin, who eventually, together with Ran Canetti, obtained the ultimate Byzantine agreement, randomized Byzantine agreement protocol, not using cryptography, but also doing the common coin by absolute non-cryptographic.
But the common coin, does there have to be a real common coin, or does each person
That's an excellent problem. The result was or the methodology was that the participants attempt to toss a common coin for each round. However, there are these, again, Byzantine agents who are attempting to foil that as well. And it turned out that if you have an essentially common coin, and not a one-half common coin, but maybe deviating somewhat from being a true one-half coin, that suffices for a very efficient solution to the Byzantine agreement problem. Variants of that are used in very wide contexts. Parenthetically, no, in work, not in our work, you and mine, Dennis, but in work I did on parallel computing, common coins and variants of Byzantine agreement played a role. So, so eventually, all of those applications and successes demonstrated the high efficacy and usefulness of randomization in algorithms, in protocols, the significance of Byzantine agreement in particular, in addition to its practical importance, was that here you had an example where demonstrably, provably, by the results of Lamport piece on the one hand, and on the other hand the Patterson-Lynch Fisher result showed that you can do things using randomization that are not doable otherwise. I failed to mention that the randomized solution for the Byzantine agreement protocol works in the asynchronous case as well, and this is of course of significant practical importance.
Michael, let me back up a little bit and talk a little bit about the general uses of randomness in computer science. There seem to be at least three streams of use of randomness: yours, the use in Ethernet protocol,
yes,
and the use in genetic algorithms, where random mutations and random recombinations sometimes lead to good solutions of combinatorial problems. Do you see any unified theme among all those three?
I would say the following. The use in the Ethernet protocol is in some sense like the use in Byzantine agreement. In Byzantine agreement, the parties want to reach agreement against improper or malicious opponents. In the Ethernet protocol, the participants want to avoid clashes, conflicts. That's somewhat similar. They are trying to get out of each other's way. I don't know enough about genetic algorithms, but they are very similar. They are of the same nature as the general randomized algorithms. I must admit that after many years of work in that area, the efficacy of randomness in, for example, expressing a number as integer efficiently, finding an expression as a sum of four squares, is absolutely mysterious to me. This is really it is efficient, it works, but why and how is absolutely mysterious. And it is also mysterious in another way, because we cannot really prove about any process, even let's say radioactive decay, that it is really random. So, for example, Einstein, rejecting the basic tenets of quantum theory, said, "Oh, God does not play dice." So he really rejected basic randomness in nature. So the randomized algorithms, in order to be really in their pure form, have to use a physical source of randomness, not a pseudo-random number sequence. So it is a cooperation between us as mathematicians, or in our computing cooperation, in our computing process, between us and nature supplying the randomness, either a radioactive source or maybe tossing a coin if we have the patience for doing that. This is really quite unique and extremely mysterious. Let me make another comment which is of methodological importance. Von Neumann already suggested back in the 1940s so-called Monte Carlo methods for computation. However, in Monte Carlo methods, you create a stochastic process behaving like a physical phenomenon, and then you observe the you sample the stochastic process, and you solve, let us say, for example, you can solve a potential problem when that potential problem behaves like a certain random walk. Values of potential in certain, at certain points are in the limit equal to frequencies in a random walk. Those processes are by, those methods are by having a stochastic process emulating a physical, or behaving according to the same equation as a physical process. Whereas the use of randomization and what are now called randomized algorithms is entirely different, and among other things use relatively small thousands of random bits, like hundreds of millions or billions of random bits used in Monte Carlo, in von Neumann like Monte Carlo methods. So let me go back to a chapter of my work that I have deliberately skipped before. I went directly from probabilistic automata to randomized algorithms because of the connection between the two. However, after the work on finite automata by Scott and myself, finite automata and their decision problems, two mathematicians, Büchi and Elgott, discovered how the theory of finite automata can be used, employed, for the solution of decision problems in mathematical logic. And in work they did in the 60s, they had first of all together, but then they split ways, they had some falling out. They have shown that the so-called Pressburger arithmetic decision problem can be solved by use of finite automata. I mentioned Pressburger before in connection with my result together with Michael Fisher, showing that the complexity of Pressburger arithmetic, of any decision procedure for Pressburger arithmetic, is demonstrably doubly exponential. So then Büchi went on to generalize finite automata on finite sequences to finite automata on infinite sequences. A very brilliant piece of work that he presented at the Congress on Logic, Philosophy and Methodology of Science in 1960, the first international congress that I have attended after I was at the Cornell University Summer School in 1958. So, in that paper, he has shown that the so-called monadic second-order theory of one successor function is decidable. Absolutely brilliant paper. Let me explain very briefly for the historical record what that means. So, you have the integers, 0, 1, 2, 3. The successor function, s of x, is the function sx equals x plus 1, i.e. s of 7 is 8, s of 11 is 12, and so on. The classical decision problems pertained usually to problems having formulated within a predicate logic, the logic of relations with the quantifiers that exists in X and for all X, and the logical connectives and relations or functions. Second order theory means that you quantify over sets. I forgot to mention that actually the Elgott-Büchi result showed that the monadic weak second-order theory of one successor function, where you quantify over finite sets, that is decidable. From this, the Pressburger decidability results follows quite immediately. The Büchi paper demonstrated that the general monadic second-order theory of one successor function, where you are allowed to quantify over arbitrary subsets of integers, that is decidable. The first result of that nature. Now, he mentioned there as an open problem whether if you have two functions. So he gave the example that you have the integers and you have the function s, say 0 of x is 2x and s1 of x is 2x plus 1. So every integer has two successors, so to speak, one of which being 2x double and the other one being 2x plus 1. Whether that monadic second-order theory is decidable. And he just mentioned that result, that open question, at the end of his paper. I never had an occasion to discuss the question with him, and Büchi is not with us, unfortunately, anymore. So, I don't know if he realized how powerful that theory, that monadic theory of two successor functions is. But I realized that this is an incredibly powerful theory, that if it turns to be decidable, if you find a decision procedure for that theory, many, many logical theories can be demonstrated to be decidable. So I set myself to work on that, and my formulation was a generalization from infinite strings to infinite binary trees. So you consider the tree where you have a root, and then the root has two children, a left child and a right child, and each of these has again two children, a left child and a right child, and that branches out ad infinitum, and you get what is called described as the infinite binary tree. And now you consider that tree with these two successor functions, left child, right child, and you want to have, you study the theory, the logical theory of that tree with these two functions, and quantification over arbitrary subsets of nodes of the tree. And then it was clear that you need a theory of automata for such trees. In 1966, I came to IBM. I was invited for a year to IBM research at Yorkton Heights. And one of the problems I set for myself was to find an appropriate theory of automata on those infinite trees and prove the decidability of the same problems that Scott and I have shown decidable for finite automata on finite strings, and as a consequence also prove that the monadic second order theory of two successor functions is decidable. With all the myriad decision problems that are going to be shown decidable as a consequence. I had in 1966, in fact, just before I came to Yorkton Heights, Andrzej Mostowski, the eminent, very eminent Polish logician, came to visit me in Jerusalem. And I told him that I intend to work on this problem with all of these possible consequences. And Andrzej said to me, "Well, Michael, since you have such extremely strong decidability results following, and we don't know whether those are decidable, the reasonable thing is to try to show that this monadic second order theory of two successor functions is not decidable." Well, fortunately, it turned out to be otherwise. I worked extremely intensively. I consider this to be the most difficult thing I did in my mathematical life, to show, and eventually I created the appropriate theory of automata on these infinite trees, and showed that it is decidable, and consequently also all those other logical theories were also demonstrated to be decidable. It follows immediately, by the way, that you can also have the decidability of the theory of a monadic second order theory of of a countable number of successor functions. So each element has a first child, a second child, a third child, omega children, same thing. Then it turned out in the work of Dov Gabay that you can interpret so-called Kripke models for non-classical logics. You can interpret in that theory of monadic second order theory of an arbitrary number of successor functions. Dov Gabay and I were standing in the math library in Jerusalem. He was a student of Azriel Levy, and he wanted to show that various non-classical logics, model logics, temporal logics, are decidable. And he was looking at the Kripke modeling of those languages. In the Kripke modeling, you have worlds, and each world has a number branching out into possible successor worlds. And I said to him, that looks exactly like the theory of automata with, you know, many successors on trees with many successors, and then you use the monadic logic in order to describe properties. And then he was able to show that everything in sight was decidable. He wrote a book on that, and he had a beautiful thesis. And then it turned out, and that was completely unexpected to me, that various temporal logics are modeled, of course, by Kripke models, and those temporal logics, which are of very significant importance in proving the correctness of various evolving computational processes, branching computational processes, are decidable, and in certain cases even have efficient decision procedures, and that became a very extensive activity in computer science. People like, first and foremost, Amir Pnueli, who is here at the Courant Institute, were using it very extensively. And there are other brilliant contributors, including Moshe Vardi, and a wonderful woman in Jerusalem, Orna Kupferman, and Shmuel Safra, and Ed Clark to some extent, but the other guy from Austin,
Alan Emerson?
Emerson, yes, who was exposed to this while at Harvard, while a student of Ed Clark at Harvard, were using that stuff. Not in their work that gave them the Turing Award, they did some other modeling, but certainly, mainly Emerson was using it also in his work on program verification. The proof of decidability of that second order theory is considered by many as being maybe the most difficult proof in mathematical logic, and there were a number of alternate proofs, starting with a very nice proof by Rykov, and then a proof by I'm in the train of thought, so the names will come to me in a minute. However, bottom line, all of those proofs are in some sense a variant on the original proof. A very remarkable feature of that original proof is that even though we are dealing with finite objects, finite automata, and the trees are infinite but are countable have, you know, finite or omega branching. The proofs, in one way or another, all employ transfinite induction, actually to a level up to omega 1, which is the first uncountable ordinal. So it is a very strange marriage between the finite and countable to the with the uncountable.
So your proofs, as well as the variants, all
yes,
use those.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. So some of those variants use the so-called Zorn lemma, for example. But if you look at the length of those chains, you see that the length of those chains are up to type omega 1.
Okay.